Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey y'all, Mark here. I'm back with not one, but two cases with my friend Alexandria from APOL Unsolved in West Virginia. I have to brag on her for a second because she has her bachelor's in criminal justice and a minor in psychology. And how she tells and handles these cases honestly blows my mind. She's definitely one of my true crime besties, so please take a second to follow her on her YouTube channel and all of her socials. They're linked in the show notes below. We recorded this episode a few weeks ago. She brought a case from Kanawha County, and I brought a case from Raleigh County. So get ready to get lost in the mystery of the cases of Angela Sharice Gwynn Stevens and Leroy Gorman. So the second case we're going to talk about is one that happened literally minutes away from here. It is the case of Angela Sharice Gwynn Stevens.
Ooh.
October 1st, 1993 started out like any other day for Sharice. She dropped her husband Norman off at work at the UPS facility, which is in Beckley, like you pass it like as you're going to Charleston. Later that day, she had lunch with her friend Paula Hager, but during lunch, she asked like a off-the-wall question. She asked if she can move in with Paula, and I mean, Paula was like, yeah, of course, because I mean,
yeah,
your bestie, you're going to tell her to, you know, move in, sure. So after lunch, there's really no idea like what Sharice did. Like, she loved to work out at LA East, which is behind the Nissan dealership in Beckley, and then, you know, we aren't sure if she went to work out, if she went to pack up some things, if she ran errands. But she went completely silent after lunch.
Did her friend not ask why she wanted to move in?
I don't think so. If she did,
I mean, I'm going to say yes, but I'm going to get some details.
Yeah.
Why do you need to move in all of a sudden?
Maybe she did, and like it's just not been released.
Yeah.
Because I mean, still kind of an open case. But you know, Norman couldn't get a hold of her. He had to have someone drop him off at work, who he could never remember his coworker's name, which is so odd in my book.
Yeah.
But the coworker was like, I didn't see anything out of place. Like, everything seemed normal. And to me, I'm like,
but his friend dropped him off at work or his house?
His house. So okay. He like drove from Beckley all the way down here to drop him off. I don't know if the friend lived around here or what.
You're just asking someone you don't know their name?
Yeah.
To drop you
like,
off?
He claims he doesn't remember their name.
Okay.
Weird.
Yeah.
So as days turned into weeks, Sharice's family, they begin to wonder. And yeah, they started to, you know, search on their own. And her aunt actually worked at, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think it was Sears. Sears or JCPenney's in the mall. And Norman would drop off packages because he was a UPS delivery driver. And she was like, have you heard from Sharice? He's like, no. And like, kept it short, sweet, just no. And she's like, oh, okay. So, months down the line, her aunt was the one who placed the missing persons report. It wasn't her family, like her parents, which I know her dad absolutely loved and adored Sharice, but I think there was like a big fight or something, so that's why the aunt reported her missing.
But Norman didn't?
No.
Or after months?
Yeah. I mean, you'll have to wait.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, you know, he did claim that the coworker and all this dropped him off. But later he changed his story and said when he was interviewed, like one of the only times he was interviewed, that Sharice called him from an out-of-state location, which I've seen was like North Carolina. Don't know how true it is.
You're always in North Carolina.
Well,
I'm convinced.
I think the reason it's North Carolina, she did move to North Carolina after high school and worked at a chiropractor's office, but ended up moving back.
But didn't Brenda send a postcard from North Carolina? Lambert?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's always North Carolina.
Yeah. It's weird. So in the call, she apparently said, I'm not coming back. So
just like that postcard said.
Yeah. Literally. So to back up here for a second, it was 1991, mm-hmm. Halloween, when they met. She was working at Spartans in the mall, and Norman was dropping off the package, and he was enamored by the girl who was dressed as Dolly Parton.
Oh,
because I can fully see Sharice dressed as Dolly, because like Sharice was beautiful, and I can see the fake nails, the big wig.
Yeah.
All that. So by May of 1992, the two had eloped in Virginia, which, I mean, it's normal around here. Like, Parisburg, the place to go. But talking to her aunt, I actually found out that she wanted to have a wedding here. And she was afraid no one would come to it. And her aunt's like, hey, people will come. But she asked friends that worked at a bank if they would come. And they're like, no, we don't want to make your mom mad. Because her mom worked at the bank at the time.
But why would her mom be mad?
Exactly. That, I'm not sure.
Huh.
So, 26 days after her disappearance, Norman filed for divorce. And it was granted the following year on Valentine's Day.
Was it for abandonment, I guess?
It's never been released. Yeah. But to me, that's the only thing they could get it on. Yeah. Because you're going to have her sign papers and everything for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
As the investigation continued, Norman declined two polygraph tests, and to this day, he's never taken one. Which, to me, I'm like, if you did nothing wrong,
yeah,
why not clear your name up?
And what year was this?
It kind of happened from, like, 93 on.
Yeah.
So this was kind of...
So we didn't know polygraphs were so...
Fail-proof.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't know they weren't great back then.
Exactly. So, you know, suspecting foul play, they organized a search on the couple's 98-acre farm, which they actually shared with his uncle at the time. And I've always got like two different stories on this, that the cadaver dogs hit on something and that they didn't. From what I was told, they were hit in like an outdoor building, which has always been described to me like a building you would put canned goods in because it would stay cold all the time.
Yeah.
But then I've been told that like it's kind of been tore down. I don't know where it would be on Apple Maps or Google Maps, whatever.
Yeah.
So a month after her disappearance, her 93 Dodge Daytona just suddenly reappeared in the UPS parking lot. And it's like me and her aunt was saying, like, she wouldn't drop it off. She loved that vehicle. It was a sporty little car back then, and like, Sharice liked the finer things in life, so I mean, of course you're going to keep a nice new vehicle. It randomly reappeared with the keys in the sun visor over the driver's seat.
Even if she dropped it off, would she not say something to Norman?
Or be seen.
Yeah. Or just be seen.
Yeah, neither happened. So...
So nobody was seen getting out of the car, though? Yeah, like, nobody saw who had the... Okay.
So, you know, no one knew what happened to the car. They just knew it reappeared because Norman sold it to a guy in Charleston. So police hunted down this guy, got the vehicle, searched it inside and out. And I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still local. I'm not going to say where. So during the time she went missing, the church they went to, which was Breckenridge Missionary Baptist Church, was under construction. They was building on like a new addition to the church, which is beautiful. Don't get me wrong. Church is absolutely beautiful. But that's when rumors started. They were kind of off the wall because everyone said she was in the septic tank at the church. Which, you know, growing up, you know, my nanny worked in a PSD. So luckily she's like, there is no way.
Yeah.
She's like her clothes, all that would have been ate up. The only thing that possibly would still be there would be a femur. because
yeah,
that is a.
It's the biggest bone in your body, right?
Yeah,
In your leg. Your thigh. Sure.
Yeah. So she's like, that's the only thing that could still be there from all the chemicals and everything in it. So she's like, I don't know. The family sent a letter to the church asking to search the property. So the letter said, "Dear members of the Breckenridge Missionary Baptist Church, the Gwynn family and friends are looking for Angela Charisse Gwynn Stevens. At the time of her disappearance, she was living in the area and had gone to this church. She had been missing for almost 12 years. We need your help in getting closure on this matter. The reason for this letter is the Gwynn family and friends would like to provide a free service to your church. We have reason to believe there are some clues to her whereabouts in the septic tank located in your parking lot. We would like to have this tank closed out so we can look for these clues. We will use licensed and trained professionals along with the proper authorities to do this. Please help us in getting closure on this matter. We mean no harm to your church. If we find nothing, then no harm done, and we appreciate your help. Just another piece of the puzzle would be taken care of. If this was your daughter, sister, or friend, wouldn't you like to know? We are asking the good people of your church to please help." So after a vote, churchgoers fully agreed to it. They're like, let's get this church searched. Let's get this church searched. I fully struggled on that. And
that's a tongue twister.
Yeah. So three people had a closed door meeting. The pastor, Dewey Lowe, Tom Harmon, which is Norman's uncle, and someone else who I'm not allowed to name, they voted against allowing the search. No idea what was ever said in that meeting. I would love to know. Would love to be a fly on the wall, because I feel like those three people definitely know what happened to her.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was years before they ever got to search. In 2008, Charisse's father actually passed away, and he said, "When I enter heaven, I'll know exactly what happened to her." In 2010, officers obtained a search for an old coal mining store on Glenview Road in Crab Orchard, which was owned by Norman's brother, Michael. Cadaver dogs picked up on a scent, and they found a bone. So it was sent to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., but it was an animal bone. The building was demolished just 2 days later. Like, the search happened on a Monday. They deemed it unsafe, destroyed it on a Wednesday.
Wow. So yeah. Did they know it was going to be deemed unsafe? No. Or was that just random?
It was just random. Yeah. And, like, I grew up, like, going by there because my aunt, like, lives near there. And, ironically, the woman who does our taxes, her building is right next to it.
Yeah.
Like, looks the same as the coal store and all that. So it's weird because you're like, this is where they found the bone. And then you're like,
but it was an animal bone.
Yeah. But I'm like, wonder if there's anything else on the property.
Yeah. It's like,
let me search.
Yeah.
So in May of 2014, the Raleigh County Commissioners addressed a long list of community issues. But one item, you know, kind of stands out to everyone. It was a petition to legally declare Angela Charisse Gwynn Stevens presumed deceased. Commissioner Linda Ebling made the motion, and it was seconded by Commissioner Reed, and it passed. Which, it always stuck out to me, like, why it was commissioners and not a court. Which I actually got to ask Charisse's aunt, and she said that's the only way Tommy could get it done. Charisse's brother. So, 25 years after her disappearance in 2017, a search for the church finally happened. And in an article by Jessica Farish for the Register Herald, Tommy said, "We would like to thank the Breckenridge Missionary Baptist Church for letting this go forward. Just another potential place eliminated. This was not our first search, and it will not be the last. It's the end of a chapter and the beginning of another." So, basically, they agreed to everything in the original letter they sent. They let teams come in, search, police, all that. And then they paid to have it, you know, repaved and all that.
Yeah.
Which Tommy said in an interview that he doesn't believe Charisse ran off. He believed, you know, she was murdered. And as of today, the case remains cold. Like, 2017 was kind of the last thing to ever happen in the case. until recently, I guess, because I've sent you the stuff. There's like so much stuff coming up with the 32nd anniversary.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, like her brother has a $50,000 reward out, which I think is still good. Yeah.
Most families keep it good. Yeah, yeah,
it was for 90 days. So it happened October 1st, so it's still good.
That's really smart to put a time limit on it because that like pushes people.
Exactly. And I mean, it got people talking, but I'm not sure if it got the right people talking.
Yeah.
But last year, actually on Halloween, a friend told me to go look on Reddit, and there was this big thing of this guy confessing that they took her to a cabin in Lewisburg, threw her off a bridge near Thurman.
What?
Killed her, all this stuff.
Oh, you told me this. Yeah. Yeah, you told me this.
And then it was deleted by Reddit. And I'm like, maybe that never happened.
Yeah.
But like Tommy's wife went on Facebook saying, you know, all these rumors are not true. This did not happen. People are just talking basically out their ass and all this.
Huh.
So that's really the case of Sharice. I mean, it's a very short case.
Yeah.
I mean, not short, but I mean, you can tell it short, but there's so much to it. And do I think it will ever be solved? I don't know. I hope.
Yeah.
Just for the simple fact, I know it drove her family crazy.
Yeah.
I do wish three people would talk, which is her mom, Norman, and Norman's uncle.
So Sharice's mom hasn't spoke a whole lot.
No.
Was she close to Norman?
They became close after Sharice disappeared. Which her dad didn't even know this. He knew Norman brought her yearbooks to them, but he had no idea he brought her majorette boots that she wore in high school. Like, they were found back in a closet after he passed away, and he had no idea. But then I want to say 2 weeks after my episode, a girl was caught on camera taking missing posters down, and it turned into this big thing on this Facebook page in town, and people were like dogging the mom, dogging the preacher, dogging all of these people.
Yeah.
And the woman didn't back down. She like fully was like, I was asked to do this. I know nothing about this woman. Don't care.
But did she say why? Who told her to take him down?
The preacher asked someone to have her take them down because the mom goes to the church and the brother, basically her son, is harassing her with these missing people posters for Sharice.
I can't ever imagine my children going missing and assuming I'm being harassed because people are looking for my daughter.
Exactly. Like, that is what? Something. Yeah.
Like she had to have hurt herself with that stretch.
But it's like this, it's a weird, like, catch-22, because there's, like, stuff I want to talk about, stuff I can't.
Yeah. You always have that with this stuff.
Yeah, and, like, I always tell people this case is my true crime origin story.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we passed the post office that Ella grew up to on that power pole there. Her picture was plastered all over it for years.
Really?
I think up until I was in high school.
And now it's just gone?
Yeah. It's gone now, but like, you saw her going into the local grocery store down here, like,
yeah.
And she was like my first Google search, like her and James Lee Haynes, my first Google searches ever.
Yeah, man, that's so sad. So, though,
yeah, basically if you have any information, call the Raleigh County Sheriff's Department or Crime Stoppers.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're
Country Roads Creeps.
We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Do you have another case?
I do. Okay, so this one's not as long as Jack's. This isn't a missing person. This is an unsolved case. And we're going back to 1982, I think. Yeah, 1982. We are talking about Leroy Earl Gorman. Talk about a tongue twister. Leroy Earl Gorman. He was born in 1921 in Fairview, West Virginia. His father was killed in an explosion during an oil fire in Breckenridge, Texas.
I never knew that.
Yep. Leroy married Helen Davis in January 1942. They later divorced in 1980, but they had two children together in the 50s, Greg and Sharon.
Now, I know Leroy had like a lot of stuff going on in Beckley. Was that during this time?
A lot of stuff going on in Beckley.
Because I know he lived in Beckley. Yes. And he was like a lot of things.
Yes. So he was, I kind of go over it in the work history a little bit. He was a friendly, outgoing, well-respected, and well-liked guy. He was a hard worker, not conservative, like political, but, you know, a conservative person. But he was thought to be a ladies' man. Now, he was not college educated, but had an extreme work ethic, like I was saying. At 19, he was in Webster Springs. He was a bank teller, Webster Springs National Bank. He then served in World War II for a little bit, but when he got back, he continued in the bank industry. This might be where you're talking about being in Beckley, because he was a vice president at Raleigh County Bank for a while, but then in 1964, he ended up moving to Charleston.
Which I've looked into this case, like I told you, just to Beckley. So, like, this is kind of all new to me, but like, he did so much in Beckley. Like, I'm like, I value my sleep. I could not be like on 12 different boards like he was. I'm like, dear Lord, dude.
He was in so much. And like, you could tell like his passion was the bank industry. Mm-hmm. And it was crazy.
Like, to not be college educated. He did well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like where I think that extreme work ethic really, you know, made him take off.
100%. I wish I had that work ethic.
Oh, I know, right? Seriously.
I value sleep too much.
I know. I love my sleep. I need a solid at least 6 hours or don't talk to me the next day. But yeah, so when he moved to Charleston, obviously he made major moves in Charleston too. He took the position at Charleston National Bank as the vice chairman, and he was also on the board of directors. By 1980, he was in charge of daily routines of the bank, and this is where he really thrived. Like, he liked being able to make the banks run better. November 1982, due to the economic recession, though, the First National Bank in South Charleston ended up failing. A former bank president, George Martin, didn't handle the lending of the bank well, and he was trying to convince Leroy to purchase a portion of the First National Bank, but ultimately he was like, no, that seems like a mess. I'm not doing that. That doesn't sound good. And the George Martin, he ended up passing away about a month before the takeover. But on November 5th, 1982, the Charleston National President, Theodore Platts, announced the takeover at the Charleston press conference. So Leroy would now have his hand in the complete takeover of the First National Bank by Charleston National Bank. This is where a lot of people start thinking things might have got a little fuzzy for him because, I mean, we were in a recession. People were desperate when it came to money. And I mean, this is, if a bank's shutting down, that's jobs too.
Yeah.
So this is where a lot of people start really looking into, like, was this a big reason something happened to him? First National had filed false condition reports concerning the bank's financial stability, and a group purchased 86% of the First National Bank in January 1981. They lost all their money, all of it. So then people started realizing, well, maybe it's the stakeholders. Maybe it's people that put money into this bank that just lost a ton of money. But he did end up, he was a chairman on multiple civic and charitable organizations like the Salvation Army, Charleston Chamber of Commerce. Like, he just kept it moving. He was like, you know, I'm a businessman at heart. I just want to work. And so he just kept going. Now, there were some rumors that he had an exotic personal life, especially in the 80s.
The tapes.
Yes, I do know about the tapes. That he supposedly made amateur porn with his friends and coworkers, you know, not knocking anything.
I'm sure he would love OnlyFans.
Yeah, we don't kink shame over here. And he thought that he would go, but is thought he went after, like, his ex-wives and ex-lovers of his friends, which, you know, I didn't see too much proof of that. I mean, the rumors were spread everywhere, but we don't, I don't know if that happened or not. So, but it is something to bring up, I guess. There were sexual harassment accusations by his coworkers, but I think later on I talk about they were deemed not to be true, but yeah, or just not, the investigation went nowhere, I should say. Now, on November 12th, 1982, Barry Manilow was actually playing in Charleston that night.
Did not know that.
And it caused the restaurants in the area to be very crowded before the show. About 5:30 p.m., Leroy was supposed to meet the Charleston National Bank vice president, Dana Pritchford, at the Steak and Ale in Charleston. It's no longer there, but it was a really big restaurant.
Yeah, I actually just learned where it was.
Yeah. Because
I have a friend that was from that area, and we
both
love Sarah's Bakery. So anytime we're over by Sarah's, we'll just go.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And they were like, yeah, it used to be down that road. I'm like, no way.
Yes. Yeah. And when you know that, it's even weirder when you hear the rest of the story. Yeah. Like, you're like, oh, really? That's where it happened?
Yeah.
Like, how did nobody see anything? Yeah. Dana arrived on time, but Gorman had gotten caught in a meeting beforehand with the representatives of the Bank of Point Pleasant, Charleston National's president, Theodore Platts, and a chairman of Charleston National's board of directors. So still working. Yeah. This man is still working.
I just want to know if Mothman was there.
Huh? I know.
I mean, Point Pleasant, Mothman had to be there in a suit.
It was the other guest. That's the true reason he was late. But so Dana waited a good 20 minutes at the restaurant for him. But you got to think, we didn't have cell phones at this time. We couldn't just text, hey, we're running late. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Couldn't, so, like, track each other.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And so I'm pretty sure at this point he was on his way, but Dana ended up leaving. I mean, it had been 20 minutes, right? And so around 6 o'clock, Leroy did show up with a date to the Steak and Ale, and it was on Ferry Street, for people that don't know. Her identity has never been publicized. I did find it because I'm crazy, but I won't out her here. I don't think she's ever had anything to do with it. They hung out at the bar and lounge area for the next 2 hours once he realized, oh yeah, Dana left. So we might as well chill a minute, you know, hang out. And they were sat at a table in the back corner a little later. Now, he seemed really happy. Like, they saw people here, and he did not seem like anything was wrong. He seemed like, you know, everything was great. He was with this beautiful woman, you know, just hanging out. He spoke to multiple people there. He even talked to Charleston Bank employee who was sitting in a booth near him. And he spoke to two people at the gaming area at the lounge. And there was a mutual friend that even talked to him passing the booth. So, I mean, there was multiple people that saw him here and everything seemed perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Around 7:40, while he was leaving, they spoke to the former bank employee and they talked for about 20 minutes before he left. And again, nothing was weird. Around 8 p.m., Leroy and his date walked across the parking lot to his Ford LTD, and his car was like facing the fence the fence was towards BF Goodrich Tire Center. I don't think it's still there.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think it's
still there. I think that entire like industrial area took it over.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the way his car was. Mm-hmm. He opened the passenger side door for his date because he's a gentleman. And he walked behind the car to the driver's side. And there was another car parked beside him. This car was backed into the spot. So the driver's door was facing like his driver's door. Mm-hmm. And Leroy might have slightly argued with this guy. Like, I think he was seen kind of talking to him. And but like his date was already in the car, so she couldn't tell what he was saying or anything. And then he just like kind of turned to the driver's seat, like, you know, he just turned to get in. And then three gunshots rang out and the car just drove away. Mm-hmm. And the car did almost hit another car leaving Ferry Street. Like that's how fast it was just booking it out of there. So it is thought that was the shooter. I mean, in that car.
Yeah.
And he like almost hit the other car to the point the car had to go off the road. Like, this guy was like a maniac pulling out, evidently. Leroy stood leaning against the car with one arm like on the door and the one on the roof. A physician who was at Steak and Ale ran out to help Gorman. And another person was initially helping Leroy after he was shot ran inside to tell the employees to call 911 because someone had been shot. Yeah. But from what I understand, he was really like, I'm fine. Like, he was just that type of person. Like, just keep it moving. We're good. Somehow I'm going to survive these three gunshots, I guess.
Got it.
Everything's good.
I'll heal soon, Superman over here.
Yeah. Around 8:15, officers C.A. Sadler and PFC Ranson were dispatched to the restaurant. Even though he was shot three times, Leroy, like I said, insisted he was not hurt and didn't need medical help. Which I just think is crazy.
Good, I mean, maybe he had like a high pain tolerance, which to me is insane. Because I mean, I like broke my arm in fourth grade. And I'm like, I'm good. They still made me go home. But you know, I was good. Didn't go to the hospital till like 10 p.m. that night.
And
like, nurses threatened to call CPS on my family. Shut everything. Up. Like, it was insane.
Yeah.
And mom's like, we didn't know till he tried to lift his arm. He broke it. Like, he was completely fine.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, especially if it's more like not one that's completely offset.
Mine was like right like middle of my arm, so
I mean, it's going to swell regardless.
Yeah
So yeah, he tried not to go to the ER, tried to just really downplay his wounds, but he did end up dropping to the ground right about this time while being interviewed by an officer. The ambulance showed up to the restaurant, took him to CAMC Memorial, and later Officer Sadler joined him and his date in the hospital room. Leroy was in a lot of pain, but lucid, and he had been shot twice in the right arm and one in the abdomen. One had hit his elbow that caused it to shatter, and then he said that he was getting into his car when he heard the gunshots. He felt a pain in his right arm and turned to face the car beside him. And that's when they think he got shot in the abdomen. He said it was a white man, dark hair that was medium length, a slim face, wearing glasses that were like his own glasses that he wore, and just very angry looking. He did say he didn't know why someone would target him. He said that there was no way that it was Dana Pitchford because he knew him well and he had already left. He said that it could have been a person sitting across the bar from Leroy and his date and the former bank employee, but I don't think the former bank employee and his date recognized him. That wasn't really specified, but I'm sure if he said that, they asked them. You know what I mean? He did say that he did not know who exactly shot him or think of anyone he could guarantee did it. So there was really not many leads at all. So initial outlets were saying Leroy was in stable condition. He actually had one bullet, though, that severed two arteries in his lower back and pierced his liver. They decided to sedate him and medically paralyze him before surgery, in which they performed like all night long. Like it took all night.
Right.
He was losing a lot of blood, though, and he just kept getting worse once the surgery started happening. And he ended up dying at 4:57 a.m. before he could say who did this. But like, thank God he was lucid enough to talk earlier. That's what I think about all the time. I'm like, most of the time he at least gave a description. Like, even if he didn't know who it was, he gave people they could roll out. Mm-hmm. He was able to give a description, and that's just not always the case.
To me, this, it's such a parallel case because it happened in Charleston too, but it reminds me of Fazio.
Yes.
The owner of Fazio's. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. She was attacked. She could talk, mm-hmm. but she again passed away in CAMC, which... Yeah. So many parallels to me.
CAMC, man. When you're down that way, you just know, don't go to CAMC. You just know it. Anyways, so when they talked to Leroy's date, she said the man looked between 25 and 30. He looked possibly Syrian or Lebanese, and he had medium to dark skin. But you've got to think, she's looking through a car window with Leroy probably standing in front of it.
And it's dark.
It's dark. Yeah. And even though the driver's side doors were lined up, like, they're kind of offset if one's backed in and mm-hmm. then his car's forward in. You know what I mean? So I've always wondered, like, how good of a description you can go off with that. Because, you know what I mean?
To me, getting in my vehicle, I'm clueless to the world. I'm not paying any... I know I need to.
Yeah.
I'm paying no mind to anyone. Yeah. So, I mean... I can fully see why it's probably not the best description.
Yeah, yeah. She did do hypnosis therapy due to this incident, which, yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily believe in hypnosis therapy. Yeah, no. I am willing to be proven wrong, though, out there. If there's any hypnotic therapists, come try. Yeah. I don't know, but, you know.
Come get out our trauma.
Yes. Oh, God, I don't know if you want to do that, but oh, it would take a whole day, but, you know. But yeah, so she did hypnosis therapy, and she just kept repeating this phrase, lights on, light off, lights on, lights off, which I thought maybe possibly there was a signal given to the shooter. Like, maybe she was thinking of a car near them, like, flickering their lights or...
To, like, be like, this is him.
Yeah. But I feel like they would have also seen if lights were flickering.
Yeah.
So I'm just not really sure, but... But yeah, that's what she kept saying. So first they started looking at the parking lot itself. Detectives Morris and Wilson joined at the parking lot. They interviewed four witnesses. Witnesses said that the man was hanging out at the BF Goodrich parking lot first. They described him as about 5'8", 5'10", and 145 to 165. And he would have been near a white or light-collared Subaru station wagon. Witnesses at first reported the wrong time of the shooting, though. So that started throwing off this investigation already. And people also said that the car looked like a brown two-door Chevrolet, like Monte Carlo or a Pontiac Grand Prix with a light-collared roof. So now they really didn't know if they were looking for a station wagon, a Monte Carlo, or a Grand Prix.
Yeah,
so that kind of makes it a little difficult, too. It does seem like it was fairly the same colors, though. You knew that at least it was a light-collared roof.
Right.
But now, you know, they expanded on what type of car they were looking for. And witnesses also described this man as late 20s, early 40s, dark curly hair. Two witnesses parked directly behind Leroy's car saw the guy sitting in the car next to Leroy's, like he was kind of like waiting for him to get out. One witness said that their headlights were on, so maybe there was a flicker.
Yeah.
And she got a really good look at him because her headlights were shining into his car. And she said it was a white man with a darker complexion, dark brown curly hair, thick eyebrows, but small eyes, no glasses, which is interesting. He said the glasses were the same as his. Mm-hmm. A full mustache, a white button-down shirt, and dark colored jeans. And she said the man was concentrating, just staring at the Steak and Ale entrance.
If someone is in a vehicle and you are staring at them, how do you know what color pants they have on?
That's what I thought.
Like, but did I'm he get out of the vehicle at some point?
Well, I'm wondering if they sat in the car long enough, they saw him walking around BF Goodrich parking lot and then got into the vehicle. But that's a long time to be sitting just in your car at a parking lot of a restaurant.
Unless you're waiting for someone to get off work or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or waiting for someone to, like, come join you. They're running late because, like, Barry Manilow's in town.
Yeah, Barry Manilow's in town. That's right. Yes. So the gun that was used was thought to be a .32 caliber handgun. There was a .38 caliber bullet found on the pavement in which a bullet that was the bullet that matched what was later found in Leroy. So it was probably more a .38 caliber. There was a small amount of this limited edition type gun. So they tried to find who owned these types of gun, but I don't think they were successful. It was rumored that the gun itself was thrown into the Greenbrier River. Yeah, but the police, I mean, there was just no way they were going to be able to locate gun.
Greenbrier River is like a far hop, skip, and a jump from Charleston.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fairly clear. Like, my dad used to have a cabin in Alderson. And I remember I could go up to, mid-thigh and see my feet perfectly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that river is really clean. But I guess maybe they just thought the guy, like, drove away really far and threw it in the river.
That's so weird.
But, yeah, that was the rumor that I was thrown in the river. Which,
I mean, if it's a hitman, could live down in that area.
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. They went to Leroy's apartment in Terrace Park East. And I think this is where it gets interesting. His condo had been broken into and ransacked as if someone was looking for something. So they went pretty much right after. They get him to the hospital. They go to his apartment. And some believe it wasn't the shooter, though. Some believe that maybe it was someone in his life that was worried about what the police were finding. You know, like amateur sex tapes.
Oh, yeah.
Or things like that. And that they were afraid, like, whatever they would find in his apartment would be unethical, embarrassing, weird, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. So we don't know. I mean, it could be someone tied to what happened to him, but it also could be someone tied to just weird things he was dabbling in his personal life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think that ever really went anywhere either.
And, like, I'm going to sound really morbid.
Yeah.
What? Like, you could sell those tapes.
Right.
Because, I mean, I'm thinking in my head, Lorraine Bobbitt's husband became a porn star.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is Leroy wasn't a bad-looking man. No.
Like...
He wasn't a bad-looking man.
No, I mean...
He honestly kind of reminded me of Anderson Cooper.
Yes. You know what
I mean? Like, he reminds me of Anderson Cooper. Yeah.
Which is not bad.
Yeah. No. Huh. So, yeah. The Charleston Police Department had tried to interview quite a few people. It's thought to be around 400 of Gorman's friends and business associates, and tried to interview an employee from the National Bank or from the Charleston National Bank, but he showed up with two lawyers, so they couldn't ever really truly interview him. So it is thought And this is not common in a lot of investigations that we talk about. But the police really did seem to do their job in this case. I mean, they were going at it hard and they were just hitting, you know,
dead
walls.
End after
dead. Yeah. So, I mean, they really tried.
Which to
get
me, that could literally just be because of his image in the public
eye. That's exactly
eye.
What yeah, it probably
I mean,
is.
That's literally all it could be because, I mean.
Yeah, he was big time. Like, he was known in that area because you got to think, like, nowadays we focus on influencers and movie stars and stuff. But, like, people knew the big businessmen in areas.
The only other case I can think of in Charleston that got this amount of attention, which I haven't looked in that many in Charleston, is the Daily Newspaper.
Yes.
I forget her name.
I forget her name, too. But, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. But, yeah, you're right. Like, it wasn't – there wasn't very many that were big, especially in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it probably was for his status.
Yeah.
Of course it probably was. But got to give credit where it's due because Charleston police is not good about missing people very often. But, like, so at least they did something in this unsolved case. But yeah, so some of the theories was he had been messing around with someone's wife, that it was a jealous husband.
I mean, that could make sense.
Yeah. But it was also proven that he was not as strong of a ladies' man as people rumored. Like, that's how he just wanted to present himself. Yeah. So it's not really thought, like I said, there was no sexual harassment charges, like what people tried to say there was, or investigations, I guess I should say. None of them had merit. They could never find any, like, of the sex tapes of his. And there was quite a few people that he was supposedly messing with that were, like, ex-lovers, ex-wives, came forward and was like, yeah, that's not true. That was just a rumor. And so people aren't really sure if that was just what he, like, you know, he just wanted that image. Yeah. You know, people like to feel good about themselves and think, you know, and sometimes that's part of it is you fake that people
want you
more just so people do want you more, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he had the image of a ladies' man.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. The police also thought because of his high profile that someone could be stalking him. That's also very possible. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do believe it was over the First National Bank of South Charleston's takeover because he could have probably put his money into it and saved it, but he knew it was doomed. What, he would save it for a few years? And also, it's like, you know, he's a businessman. He weighed his options, and that just wasn't a good option. Think of all the people that lost money, you know? The police did start thinking it was a murder for hire plot, and it could be because the stockholders lost so much money.
I can see that.
Yeah. And I mean, in a recession, people are going to be desperate for their money. That's just how it is. So that was about as far as the police could get with it. People did end up coming to the police later saying that they didn't feel as bad for Leroy dying as they portrayed. Police thought that was really weird.
That's insane.
Yeah. Some going as far to say that he got what he deserved. So again, people start kind of linking it back to this takeover. Like, you ruined all these families' lives by not, you know,
so
investing
you
in
death.
This. Yeah. I mean, you hear that all the time now.
Yeah.
Think about just the CEO that was killed. Well, you made these decisions and it affected everyone. Like, and people literally celebrated that man's death, which I just don't think you should celebrate anybody's death ever. But you know, this is kind of the same thing. It's like, well, you didn't put your money into this and all these people lost jobs, all these stakeholders lost money, so you deserved it. But on December 16th, 1982, police decided to release a composite sketch created by John Foster. It did bring in several new leads, and the sketch looked like the man trying to enter the November 5th press conference and announcing the takeover of the First National Bank. So people thought that was really weird. But back then, you didn't log everyone that came in. You didn't have the security, the cameras. So there was no way to track down this guy of who was there. Yeah. So,
because, I mean, if he was trying to get in, who's to say he wasn't just shoot him there at the press conference.
Or at least get a good look at him. Mm-hmm. Be like, okay, that's the guy.
But would you also do that in a room full of people unless you like sit in the back, wait out your options?
Yeah. So I think he was probably scoping him out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being like, okay, that's the guy. That's what he looks like. And that's where he started following him in ways around town and stuff. Yeah. In February 1983, a reward of $250,000 was announced, which is one of the biggest rewards I had ever heard, but nothing came of it, which also made people think it must have been a murder for hire plot. Someone that wasn't from there, people didn't know, didn't talk to anybody, just kind of came in and did their thing.
Which could also make sense for the Greenbrier River gun being thrown.
Yeah. I lean more towards a murder for hire thing than anything.
I mean, that's where I've dabbled in the case, like I've said, but I've always thought it was murder for hire.
Oh, yeah. Easily, right? In January 1986, the chief of police, Kent Carper, got Leroy Gorman's case and Stanley Law's case reopened. Detectives Patrick Legg, Sam Sampson, and Richard Westfall took a fresh look at these two cases. Now, the murder of Stanley Law was solved but Leroy's was not. They were able to discount jealous lovers rumors, like I said, discount the porn rumors, disproved narcotic allegations, and thought that it would have to do with business dealings, but never got any farther than that and never got enough to bring charges to anybody. So they were able to still even work on the case a little later. But the last thing that really anybody can say about this case is that in 2012, Steak and Ale building was demolished. We don't think anything really happened in the Steak and Ale building, of course, but it was, you know, hard for people in the case that, you know, you want the place that something happened to kind of still stand until things are solved. That's just kind of how we are as people.
And I mean, us, we would.
Oh, this is where
the murder happened.
Like, meet me at Steak and Ale. We're going to dinner. Yeah, literally, we're going to scope the parking lot afterwards.
So, what did Leroy have eat that night? I had the same thing.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Where did he sit?
I want his booth.
Yes. So, 2 hours at the bar, and then that booth got it. You know? Yes. But yeah, that's all that we know about the Leroy Gorman case. And how scary is it to have this much effort into an investigation and still
nothing. Yeah,
still nothing.
Which I wonder if, like, down the line, if they would ever reopen it, but
yeah,
I don't know if they would.
I don't know, because it doesn't sound like they have any true idea who that person is. They just know what they're looking for.
True.
So how do you track that now?
Especially today. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, you have because, I mean, well, I guess if, let's say they were from the Alderson area, you would have to go the turnpike, basically, if the turnpike was there during then. Don't quote me on that. I don't know if the turnpike would have cameras in or not.
In 1982? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely not.
No.
Which I don't even know if the turnpike would have been there, but it might have been being built.
And you've got to think, a murder for hire, they're probably not from West Virginia at all. So even if they threw it in the Greenbrier River, that's probably to offset wherever they're from. They're not going to go home and throw it away.
True.
But like, they would go out of their way.
Long way.
Yeah. Maybe that's on their way from where they're from. I don't know.
I'm trying to think, like, what can you get to from that area?
I know, that's what
Virginia
I was
Virginia and stuff.
Yeah.
That's really it, because, I mean, you're basically almost to Virginia there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that would be the smartest, to hire someone just right outside the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, but that's all we have on Leroy Gorman.
I want more.
I know. I want more, too. Like, it seems like it should be so easily solved. And unfortunately, there is nothing. And I feel bad for his date, though. Like, I can't imagine carrying that with me the rest of my life.
Like, how traumatized would she have been?
Yeah. And, like, I mean, they classify her as his date. So in my mind, that doesn't mean they knew each other well.
Yeah.
Like, probably they've went on more than one date, but if it was like someone he was committed to, wouldn't they call her his girlfriend, his partner, his wife, yeah. you know, something like that. So it's like, so you think you're just going out with this date of this, you know, nice, fancy man, and then you're part of a murder.
Yeah.
How crazy.
Literally. I mean, I can't even imagine.
No, I'm out. At that point,
literally, like, I don't think I would be going on another date for a very long time.
Yeah, but I do feel like in way, well, maybe it's just courtesy too, but I mean, she would have to know him a little bit because she stayed at the hospital with him. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
I feel like we need to go knock on the Charleston police door and be like,
hey,
can I see the case files?
I know, right? I wonder if they'd let us.
Well, thank you for coming here today and giving me all these cases. I love every single second of it. Like, you are a true crime bestie.
Oh, you're a true crime bestie.
I love it. This definitely won't be the last one.
No.
No. So you guys just stay tuned because she will be back.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you are more than welcome.
Yes. Check out my YouTube too.
Yes. I love her videos. Watch them. I literally listen to them when I'm like working overnight. I'll just like put it on my phone and listen. I'm like,
I love that so much.
Love it. So yeah.
Aw, thank
you. Until next time.
Yes. Bye, guys.
I just want to take a second and thank Alexandria again for coming on. This isn't the only two episodes she will ever be on. She is definitely a part of the Mountain State Mysteries world now, and she will forever be a part because she is someone who I will text every single day about cases. We have talked about so many cases that we want to cover together that we may even be traveling to cover. So stay tuned for that. We will be taking next week off, but we will return the following week with a brand new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, like, and download the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast. Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.